Wouldn't you like to ride in my beautiful balloon? Would you like to ride in my beautiful balloon?
Twice a day, meteorologists at the National Weather Service launch weather balloons. A device is attached that sends back atmospheric readings, but there's a controversy brewing over the gathering of that data, which could affect the accuracy of tomorrow's forecasts. That's one of the topics coming up on Jet Streaming. We'll get into all the hubbub over the use of a new radio sonde in just a moment. First, I have to say hi to my cohorts in climactic crime, Paul Huttner and Mark Seely. How are you guys?
Very good. Adjusting to November. Finally feels like it around these parts.
I hadn't heard that music in a long, long time, Kathy.
Leave it to us to brush the dust off of that.
Brought me right back to my parents' living room in the late 60s.
And that's not good, actually. Well, there seems to be, getting more serious here, there seems to be a lot of talk about the move by the National Weather Service to change over to these new radio sondes. And before we talk with our guest, Paul, just explain briefly what's going on.
Well, these radio sondes are launched every 12 hours at nearly 100 sites around the U.S. by meteorologists. From the National Weather Service. They go outside, they attach a 4-pound instrument pack to a helium-filled weather balloon and launch it up into the atmosphere, and it can go up all the way up to 60,000 feet or more. This data is critical for forecasting severe storms. It goes into the computer models we use every day to forecast tomorrow's weather, and even for research on climate change. In 2005, the National Weather Service began a new radio sonde replacement program using some new units from a new supplier. And that's when some meteorologists began to notice problems with the data. Bob Maddox is one of them. He's one of the premier severe storms researchers in the world. He was director of the National Severe Storms Laboratory in Norman, Oklahoma from 1986 to 1996, and is now an adjunct professor with the University of Arizona, devoting time to studying the monsoon in Mexico and the southwestern United States. Bob, thanks for being on Jet Streaming today.
No problem, Paul. Happy to be.
What specifically are some of the problems we're seeing with this new generation of radio sondes that the National Weather Service is now using?
Well, I can step through a list for you, Paul, of of problems that I've noted over the past 6 months.
Give us the top two or three.
Okay. Probably the first one that caught attention was that when they started taking soundings out here in the west and the southwest, with high temperatures and low humidity, the humidity readings would jump to extremely low levels as soon as the sonde was released. So that's a problem, well, that I call too dry and low levels.
Mm-hmm.
So that can affect a lot of things.
Up here in the Twin Cities, I know we chatted earlier, and you said that in some areas, and this was really interesting to me, that FM radio signals perhaps are interfering with some of the chips on these sondes and causing a loss of wind data. Is that some information that you've been getting as well?
Yes, I guess I would say that's probably the most severe problem in that the winds are critical for a lot of different aspects of the forecast, and a number of sounding sites around the country, including Chanhassen, Minnesota, there just to your east, have been having problems all through the summer, losing the GPS signal lock and missing winds.
Bob, I wanted to, in a larger context, ask the question, the radio sonde replacement that's underway, we don't yet have all National Weather Service launch sites using the identical equipment yet, do we? Is it about a 50-50 mix, or what's the mix?
I'd say it's up to about 60% of the upper air stations have been converted over to the new sonde package.
And then, even in a larger context, worldwide, are there? Oh, I don't know, maybe a half a dozen different manufacturers, so that on a worldwide basis, our upper air data sets critical to forecasting. And also, as Paul alluded to earlier, some of the climate science communities as well. Is there disparity, do you think, in the quality of data in terms of that global radiosonde network?
Well, that's not a problem that I've specifically looked at, but I think you can say that since there are a number of different manufacturers of the instrumentation, there are inhomogeneities undoubtedly in those data, and they are critical for initializing the global models.
In general, Doctor, how concerned are you about this situation?
Well, I'm extremely concerned about it because I've spent my career working with just this type of data, and it affects inaccurate data affects the ability to make a forecast for convective storms this afternoon. The wind problems affect the models, and I guess I'm most concerned for future researchers not being aware that there are a lot of problems in the sounding data that have been going into the archives in Asheville since this program started.
Bob, we should probably point out in fairness that it's really not an issue with the local National Weather Service offices. I've worked with the office in Tucson there, the Twin Cities office here. I know they're both top-rate weather service offices around the country. They're given the sondes, and they send up the ones they're given. But how widespread are the problems that you're seeing? Is it just a few sites around the country, or is it quite a few sites?
Well, it depends upon the day, Paul. On a day like today, where it's beautiful weather in almost the entire country, I did a quick check, and there were, looks like, five soundings taken around the country today had problems with the temperature and dew point layers. And three soundings taken at different stations today had missing winds.
Wow.
But the numbers go way up if there's lots of precipitation and lots of weather going on around the country.
So we don't really know how this data may be affecting some of the computer models that it's feeding into, do we?
We don't know, and really and truly the only people with the expertise and the resources to assess that are those back at the National Center for Environmental Prediction, the folks that run the models.
I was just going to ask, who's responding to these concerns?
Well, I'm sure there's lots of internal response going on in the Weather Service. I guess what got me most upset was that there are problems with the data. People inside the Weather Service have known it actually before the program started. In their testing at two sites before implementing it, they identified a dry bias in the upper atmosphere. But that information hasn't moved very far outside of the Weather Service. So lots of users are sitting here not even knowing there's a replacement program going on, much less that there's some very significant problems with some of the data.
Are there any fixes on the way that we know about?
I do know from secondhand information that there's been a high priority effort to try to correct the loss of the winds, because that's a very serious problem.
In terms of the humidity measurements, Bob, I know one friend of mine who works for the Weather Service has alluded to the fact that part of the fix might be the location and volume of air that is sampled by the sensor on the new radiosonde. Are some of these sensor fixes rather simple and they're just not being attended to, or are they not being attended to because they're quite complex?
Well, okay, I'm not an engineer, but I suspect that actually fixing what your friend alluded to is, involves modifications to the actual sonde package itself to get a better and more representative airflow past the sensors. And so I think basically, I mean, my simpleton interpretation is the package is too small. It was developed for field use by the military. And so quite a bit of restructuring of the instrument package will probably be needed to improve the temperature and the humidity data.
Now, I know, Dr. Maddox, that this issue has made news in some parts of the country, and I'm wondering what happens next?
I guess I would say it's in the Weather Service Office of Systems, the folks that brought us the program to work with the vendors and try to fix the various problems. And like I said earlier to Paul, I know they're working in a high-speed mode to try and correct the loss of winds problem.
And I'm sure, Dr. Maddox, you'll be following this as well as folks like us. So we really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
You're most welcome.
By the way, Bob's website is madweather.com for information on this and many other topics.
On your cap and your coat, come on, it's time to go. Bundle up, cause don't you know that outside is pouring down snow.
Have you ever wondered why it is that 35 or 40 degrees in October or November feels a whole lot colder than it does when it's 35 in, say, March? Even weather wizards noticed the change, and we wanted to know what gives with our bodies this time of year. Joining us with more on this is Dr. Susan Chaplin, a biology professor from the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota. Welcome to Jet Streaming, Doctor.
Thank you.
I feel like such a weenie this time of year. The temperature drops below 50, and I'm searching for my mittens and my scarves and that kind of thing. What gives?
Well, I think there's two things going on there. One is that fall time is the time when we kind of rev up our metabolic rate in order to produce more heat, and that keeps us warm. But in addition to that, I think there's something else going on that's real important, which is that we try to be more conservative of the heat that we're losing to the outside air. What I mean by that is that we tend to constrict the blood vessels in our hands and feet and send that blood more to the central core, and that keeps us from cooling off. The skin gets cool, but the central core does not, so that helps us feel a little warmer as well. Now, that process probably takes several weeks, so as you're adjusting, you're still feeling cold, but by February and March, you're fully adjusted, and the tendency to feel cold when you go outside is much, much reduced.
That's interesting, Susan. I've noticed in my own habits that I start to layer my clothing immediately when the weather turns cold. But then as we get a little bit deeper into winter, I don't think I'm quite so cognizant about that.
Right. You know, it's interesting that you say you're actually behaving in a way that is very intelligent, but what I see here at the university is students walking around, for example, this morning with bare legs and bare heads and bare arms, and I think they're in denial.
Yeah, that's probably going on. You're right. Say, one other facet to this is, do you think there are subtle changes in our diet as we go into winter? In other words, do you think we change a little bit in that direction as well?
Does it make a difference if I tell you all I had a big donut this morning?
I love those carbs.
You know, you might have noticed that you tend to crave starch in the fall and maybe even high-fat foods. And I think this has to do with the energy production as well. Starch is very easily metabolized, and it's an easy source of energy for heat production. So I think we do tend to become kind of selective in our dietary choices in the fall. And I might add that, you know, it's actually been shown that it is not so much the cold weather that's doing this to you, but it is actually the changing photoperiod. So when the amount of light hours that diminish, I think it's below 12, your whole body physiology tends to change.
Yeah.
The temperature just is an added stimulant of that.
Yeah, and we're down below 10 hours of daylight now. Susan, Paul Huttner here, wondering why, in addition to everything else, people seem to get tired this time of the year. Does that have to do with the daylight, or is that a temperature effect?
Well, I think that's another sort of interesting physiological response. You know, we're not hibernators, but there are some mammals that are. And all of them are cued by changing dilate hours. They know that it's not going to be a productive time to try to go out and find food in winter with short daylight. So they tend to do a lot more sleeping. And even though we're not so typical of that type of animal strategy, I still think we have kind of an instinct physiological response that drives us in the same direction. So we feel a little more tired. Being tired also is helping you to conserve your heat so that, you know, that you're sleeping and you're under blankets and so forth. So you're conserving that energy.
I'll remember to say that next time I'm taking a nap. I'm
conserving. Exactly.
Leave me alone. How has evolution played a role in all of this?
Well, I think, you know, I was kind of alluding to that, wasn't I, respect to other animal strategies. Humans are not so different from the typical animal pattern. Most mammals, because they have high body temperatures and are very prone to losing heat, and that's an energy-expensive kind of lifestyle, want to be conservative. I say want in the evolutionary sense here. It's a selective advantage to be energy conservative in the wintertime, and I think we kind of follow that same pattern.
You know, I'm presuming that the same situation happens physiologically when you have folks in warmer weather climates too, you know, as they kind of get ready for hot, dry, or hot, humid weather.
Yeah, I think we have to relearn how to sweat, don't we? And the opposite thing would be true. That is, you bring blood to the surface, and you're very good at radiating heat by bringing that blood up. So, yeah, we do acclimate to either the cold or the hot temperatures.
Is it good for you, Susan? For example, I find myself doing exercises at the gym a few times a week.
Well, good for you.
And in the wintertime, I will go into the sauna, or, you know, I'll go in someplace that's excessively warm that amplifies the sweat I've worked up by my workout. But I'm wondering, in terms of physiological adjustment, is that something the body just normally adjusts to in the winter season, or does that actually impose an additional layer of stress?
Yeah, you're trying to educate your body to be efficient at producing heat, which exercise is great for doing that. But then you're confusing it by saying, okay, I'm going to go sit in this hot sauna and make myself sweat. And then the blood vessels have to dilate and bring blood to the surface of the skin. But, you know, we're very adaptable. I don't think it's really a problem.
Actually, Mark is cringing over here now. bad move.
No. I really do think we're very adaptable, physiologically speaking. I don't think that's a significant stress. But I do think that going to the gym and getting your metabolic rate up by exercise is a terrific idea, because muscles do continue to metabolize after the exercise, and that will help you generate heat to stay warm.
Susan, I've seen some studies that tie changes in barometric pressure to many health effects. What is the latest on that? And are we affected by extremely high pressure that we get here with Arctic air masses in the winter?
Yeah, I don't actually know physiologically the basis for that, but I do know that people respond. Some are more sensitive than others. Mostly it has to do, I think, with the pressure in their joint capsules, mm-hmm. and the fluid pressure there is being influenced by the outside barometric pressure. So some folks can tell you that a front is coming through just by virtue of the joint ache. You know, animals can orient by pressure changes and so forth, but I don't think we have that kind of sensitivity.
You had a great explanation for why some of us tend to overeat this time of year, and I really appreciate that. I don't feel so bad, I guess, anymore.
You're trying to lay on that energy store, right?
That's right.
That donut's important.
Well, I know. Well, Susan, thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
Take care.
Enjoyed it.
That's
bye-bye.
Dr. Susan Chaplin. She's a biology professor from the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul. Now, time for the weather website of the week. We have to change that. We have to get like some snowstorm sound effects or something like that. Dr. Seely, the stage is yours.
Well, thanks, Kathy. As we migrate into this time of year, it might be interesting for some of our listeners to look at upper air data, or what we call radiosonde data, topic that's very timely. The freezing level in the atmosphere has dropped, as it typically does in November. That is, it's nearer to the surface. And looking at temperature structure can tell you a lot about cloud forms that you're going to observe this time of year. So The National Center for Atmospheric Research has a real-time weather display website, rap.ucar.edu/weather/upper is where you want to look at the upper air data displays. They've got links that explain how to interpret these displays and also hints at looking at them from the standpoint of anticipating what kind of weather you might see. So I would encourage people that are true weather geeks that want to look at what's going on in the upper air to give that site a try.
Give me that address one more time, Mark.
It's rap.ucar.edu/weather/upper.
/weather/upper. And by the way, for folks who are not as fast writing as I am, we will put it on our website. You just click on. Sounds fun.
Yes, it does reveal a lot of interesting information this time of year, and especially from the standpoint of looking at, say, snow versus liquid precipitation and things like that. It sometimes helps interpret that sort of thing.
Good job. Gentlemen, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, Kathy.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us. Many thanks also to Sarah Fleener for putting together this podcast and putting up with me. And also, thanks to people who have dropped us a line saying you listen. Hello, by the way, to Jay in Sioux Falls. Thanks for listening, Jay. If you have a comment or question, drop us a line at Jet Streaming by going to minnesotapublicradio.org and heading to the Jet Streaming podcast site. Until next week, remember to keep your eyes on the sky.